This and other podcasts are available on the Gun Rights Radio Network, gunrightsradio.com. Podcasting freedom.
Hello, everybody. You are listening to my dad on the Handgun World Podcast. Why does he carry a gun? Because he can't carry a cop.
Hey everybody, I'm Bob Main. Welcome to another episode of the weekly Handgun World podcast. I carry a gun because I can't carry a cop. This is episode 255. This week I am going to get into a lot of listener voicemails. As a matter of fact, I've got so many voicemails in line that I'm not going to get to them all this week or this show would be too long. So I'm going to spend this week and next week covering them. You want to listen to these next two episodes. The reason you do is because there's a lot of good stuff in these voicemails coming up. I got a lot of responses from my episode on safeties, which I thought I would. See, folks, I did that on purpose because I knew that some of you would have some pretty strong opinions about them. And you're going to hear those opinions. So many thanks to all of you. I got a lot of different subject matter that's going to be covered. So let's get started with the first one. Let's listen to Byron. And he's got something to say about bringing a knife to a gunfight when Alan called in and kind of took me to task about that. And he's got a few other little things to share with us. Here you go.
Bob, Byron from North Carolina. Just finished listening to your podcast on safeties. Really enjoyed the podcast. Really enjoy everything you do. Also listened to your survival podcast. I just found that recently, so I'm slowly going through it there. I got a bone to pick. I know this is a hate mail. The first bone is about Alan and his call about don't bring a knife to a gunfight. I have to disagree with Alan. I have to question if the gentleman has ever been in any form of a combat scenario, whether it's been on the street or in the military. I was a Marine Corps infantryman from 98 to 07. So I've been in a couple of places and just a couple of fights. I honestly would go for my knife more often than I would go for my firearm simply because of my line of work. I am unable to carry my firearm 99% of the time. And the other thing is that a knife is a tool. And everybody keeps talking about the 21-foot rule. I listened to your knife guru on the survival. And even Mr. Fritz spoke about that when they were showing the high school football kids the 21-foot rule. So a knife is an amazing tool, and it is lethal at every angle, to whereas a firearm is lethal at only one end, and that's the end that the round come out of. So if you get off the X and get yourself away from the end of that barrel, a lot of hand-to-hand combat comes into this, and I've been training since I was a little boy in hand-to-hand combat. So in doing all of this, whether it be firearms related, knife work, or hand-to-hand combat, you have to have all three in order to be, I think, very proficient and well-rounded. Because if you only rely on your pistol, what happens when you don't have your pistol? If you only rely on your knife, what happens if you don't have your knife? At least you can fall back to your base level of training. Yes, that is true. I speak from experience. At least you have your hand-to-hand combat. Now, I'm going to use your words against you, Bob, in the discussion of safeties. I was brought up, I was taught shooting on a 1911. I understand it's a lifestyle. I love the interviews you had with Mr. John Hadaway, an amazing man, an amazing opinion of the .45 platform. But here's what I'm going to say to that. I think it's a training issue.
Byron, I agree with your assessment on bringing a knife to a gunfight. I think you kind of hit the nail right there on the head. You probably said it better than I could say it, or better than most of the other feedback on this subject. So I'm not going to add much more to that. As far as safeties, it is a training issue. Now, later on in this episode, I'm going to discuss some feedback that I got regarding my safeties episode. As I mentioned, a lot of you responded. Yes, it's a training issue. I'll say this, though, Byron. Oh, by the way, I wanted to say thank you for your service. I appreciate that very much. And so I respect where you're coming from, because you've obviously been in a lot of combat. Yes, it's a training issue. Disengaging safety is a training issue. But like I've said many times, I've seen supposedly very well-trained shooters miss that safety. Sometimes they miss it in a training class. Sometimes they miss it in a competition match. And no matter how good you are and how well-trained you are, you can miss it. Rarely have I ever seen anybody miss pulling a trigger. I'm not saying that it can't happen. I'm just saying it's extremely rare. Maybe missing a safety is rare too. I don't know. But the fact that it's a training issue also kind of leaves it to chance. And here's what I mean by that. The more actions that a person has to remember to make their gun fire, in my humble opinion, means the more room for error in making that gun fire. Okay? That's kind of my thoughts on that. But Byron, thank you very much. And I really respect, like I said, your service and your opinion regarding this issue. Okay, let's take the next one.
Hey, Bob. This is Jeff from Nebraska. About a year and a half ago, I bought my first handgun. It was a Smith & Wesson M&P9. I've always cleaned it. I've always followed the instructions that, you know, they give you, and always field stripped it, cleaned it every time I shot. And after your recent podcast on gunsmithing with Smith & Wesson M&Ps, I decided maybe it was a good time to finally tear that gun a little farther apart than, you know, just the standard cleaning that the owner's manual says. And what I noticed when I finally got into it is my sear block has a section in the middle of it that's a lot more rounded than the outside. I assume this is standard wear. I assume this is just, you know, happens after you run about 2,000 rounds through a gun. But my question to you is this something to be concerned about? Is it something that would give me a good reason to go out and get that that new trigger job done? Or is it something that is just going to make my gun shoot like it's worn in a little bit and not to worry about? So I thought maybe that, you know, when do you bother replacing some of these parts? How do you know when they're worn out? And honestly, after 2,000-3,000 rounds, is replacing some of this stuff just for a better, sharper trigger worth it? But thanks for your time. Love the podcast. Talk to you later.
If your gun's working fine, I wouldn't go out and replace it right now. What you're probably noticing there, Jeff, is wear on the gun. And I don't mean wear in a bad way. I mean it's getting broken in and parts are starting to smooth out. Trigger parts are starting to smooth out. I'm not a gunsmith, so I'll preface this by saying I'm not a gunsmith and I didn't take an M&P armorer's course or anything like that. But as long as it's functioning pretty well, I wouldn't mess with it. I do think it's a good idea, though, for any pistol that anybody decides to rely on. Have spare parts. I've talked about this before. Let me say it again. Have spare parts. Have spare trigger parts. Have spare springs. That's very important. Spare springs, because springs break easily. Of course, spare magazines. Hopefully that goes without saying. You should have plenty of those. At least 10 magazines for every pistol, probably for every caliber. 10 magazines for every pistol and every caliber. You might say, oh, that's a lot. That's a lot. Well, guess what? Magazines are relatively cheap again. Of course, except M&P magazines. All right. Had to get that in there. But, Jeff, I think as long as you have plenty of spare parts, I'd leave with it. Leave it alone. I'm not a really huge fan of changing out trigger parts if it's your carry gun. Now, the Apex trigger parts are so popular for M&Ps
that I think I might be kind of lightening my position on that a little bit. If you get the duty trigger by Apex and you drop it in there, it'd be pretty hard to argue, I think, that dropping your trigger weight 1 pound or something like that creates a hair trigger. I mean, that would be kind of a tough argument for them to make against you, I think, especially since Apex calls it a duty trigger and they're so widely used. But don't significantly alter the stock trigger at all if you can help it. I'm going to rely on Ben and anybody else that knows quite a bit about M&Ps to go ahead and call in if you have some more feedback for Jeff. The voicemail number is 210-646-1727. Once again, that's 210-646-1727. Also, if you go to that great website called handgunworld.com, scroll down to the lower right, you're going to see a Call Me button. You don't even have to remember my phone number. Just scroll down there, click the Call Me button. It's going to ask for your phone number. It'll link your phone up with my voicemail. Okay, let's go to the next one.
Hi, Bob. My name is James, and I'm calling from suburbs of Chicago today. And I just wanted to comment on your last podcast with the two nice people from Texas Law Shield, I believe. And I thought that was an excellent podcast. However, obviously I live in Illinois, and I was really excited and hoping that they would have something for more people across the U.S. Obviously do not. However, digging through the Internet the other day, I came across a new company that's called Second Call Defense. And I was really blown away by their website. It sounds as good, if not much better, than what was presented as far as the Texas Law Shield and even Armed Citizens Legal Defense Network. So my question to you is maybe it would be nice if you could at least pass this along to all your other listeners and perhaps look into it yourself and maybe do another show on all of these companies, and maybe provide some more advice as far as which one would be best for whom. But I was really impressed with Second Call Defense, and I just wanted to pass it along to you. Love your show, doing a great job, and I wish the very best for you and your family. I hope things are going well. I know you're in everyone's thoughts and prayers. So take care, Bob. Thanks.
So after I got that voicemail from James, I went to their website, secondcalldefense.org, secondcalldefense.org. There'll be a link in the show notes. It does look like a pretty good program. First of all, James, I want to say it's really cool to see that Illinois now has concealed carry, although I've heard people say that they're making it pretty difficult on people. But nevertheless, they were forced into giving people in the state of Illinois their Second Amendment rights. Well, okay, I said that wrong. They were stopped from taking their Second Amendment rights away. They didn't give them their Second Amendment rights. It's just they were stopped from taking those away. James, you have a great idea. I think I am going to probably do one full show coming up soon about organizations like this. Texas Law Shield, Armed Citizens Legal Defense Network, secondcalldefense.org. Seems to be a lot of these types of programs. It's a little different than insurance. People have asked me about concealed carry insurance. In the last Texas CHL class that I took, people asked me about concealed carry insurance. I recommended all of them become members of Texas Law Shield, those that were in Texas taking my Texas CHL class. By the way, that class turned out to be really cool. It was one of the better ones that I've had a chance to teach because we had some good shooters. That was great. We even had three people that never shot a gun before, and these people who never shot a gun before did pretty well. Of course, I like to think that they probably had some good instruction from a pretty good instructor. You know what I mean? Anyway, secondcalldefense.org. James, thanks for bringing that to my attention. I might even reach out to those folks and see if I can get them to come on this show. Let's take the next voicemail.
Hi, Bob. My name is Jim, and I'm calling from Chicago. I just got done taking my
CCL, as we call it here in Illinois, a couple of weeks back, and I thought the qualification part of our class, if you will, was extremely easy. I understand that a lot of people don't train like most of us do, go to classes, etc., but I thought 30 rounds from 5, 7, and 10 yards to land anywhere on a B-27 target was just absurd. And I kind of got on a forum here in Illinois, and I'm really getting chewed up in the forums with those comments. I thought the qualification was kind of a joke. I would like to think that more people they're going to be carrying in the state of Illinois actually can hit what they're looking at. I would feel a little better if the state requirement would have been a little stricter. Again, I'm a MAG 40 graduate. I've taken many other classes, so I am a good shooter. I'm not patting myself on the back. I just think that people that pay the money and go shoot 30 rounds anywhere on a B-27 target and think that they're going to be able to protect themselves or others, including me, if I'm in the area, is they're mistaken. So just love to hear your thoughts about that and look forward to hearing from you soon. Thanks, Bob.
Well, of course it's a joke. It's definitely a joke. The concealed carry qualifications in any state are a joke. You know, it's 50 rounds here in Texas instead of 30 rounds. But, you know, all it is the state minimum that some politicians in the state decide that now all of a sudden you're qualified to carry a gun. And, you know, most of the politicians that write these laws don't shoot. So that's kind of what's hilarious and kind of absurd as well. But I agree. Yeah, it's absurd. You know, now, of course, you know, a lot of people will argue with me, and they have argued with me, saying that no training should be required whatsoever to get your concealed carry license. After all, it's a Second Amendment right. And after all, we shouldn't have to have a license to exercise a right. And while I agree with that, there's a certain level of responsibility, a huge level of responsibility that comes with carrying a gun. And yeah, people that can just stand there and fire 30 rounds and put it into that huge area on the target in order to pass the qualification test, it is a joke. So here you've brought up kind of this... what's the word I'm looking for? You've brought up this real contentious argument. Should a decent level of proficiency training be required or not to carry a concealed handgun? I am from the camp that says yes, it should be required. Now, again, I hear I can see people's hair standing up on the back of their neck, right? And I hear some of you are starting to get all agitated, and you're frothing at the mouth, and your face is getting red, and you're about ready to just put your fist through whatever device that you're listening to my podcast on. Bob, how dare you say that anything be required for us to exercise our Second Amendment rights? Well, you make the decision, folks, but I kind of side with this voicemail, and please, 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 please don't anybody start sending me hate mail or hate voicemails telling me that I'm not a true Second Amendment advocate, because I wouldn't have done this podcast for 4 years and put in the hard work that I put in if I didn't believe that everybody possesses the right. It's been given to them, and you should use those rights. But Jim brings up a good point, doesn't he? All right, let's take the next one.
Hi, Bob. My name is Doug from Illinois, and I've got concealed carry permits from Arizona and Florida, and I've been through the laws in those states and, you know, what they allow and what they don't allow. I was wondering if you might have a chance to take a look at the new Illinois concealed carry law with its many, many, many restrictions. And I know it takes you some time to go through it, but if you could do some comments and kind of compare the restrictions in Texas or other states that you are familiar with what Illinois is trying to do to us. I'm real sad, you know, that we, I'm glad we got the actual facilitary law in, but for me, it just seems so restrictive that, you know, I'd have a hard time walking out of the house and going someplace for a day and walking someplace that they've got to, restricted and not being able to secure my firearm. So if you got a chance, you know, maybe peruse over that massive restriction list and compare it to other states and just let me know how you feel about what we're going to have to deal with and to carry a gun concealed in the state of Illinois. Hey, I've been listening to the show for a long time. You're doing a great job. I hope to come down to San Antonio one of these days and meet you in person. And you have a great day, and we'll be listening. Bye now.
It's great to get all these calls from Illinois and from Chicago and stuff. This is awesome. I mean, you know, who would have thought when I started doing this 4 years ago, there were two states, I believe, that did not allow any kind of concealed carry at all. One was Wisconsin, the other was Illinois. And my home state, my home state of Wisconsin finally got with the program. And now they offer concealed carry. And boy, do they ever. It's easy to get a concealed carry license in Wisconsin, and now they've all of a sudden become a very nice gun-friendly state. You know, open carry was legal in Wisconsin for a real long time, but people just didn't do it, and now they've got concealed carry, and it's awesome. Well, now Illinois is on board. Well, Illinois is on board, sort of. So, Don wants me to comment. Well, first of all, for those of you who don't know, here's what you have to do to get a license to carry in Illinois. You have to pay a $150 fee. Okay, well, $150 fee, that's pretty comparable to other states. Be subject to fingerprinting. Okay, that's it. They all have that. Next is undergo 16 hours of training. 16 hours. Wow, Texas just reduced theirs to 4. Hey, and I got to say something about that. A couple weeks ago, I taught my first Texas CHL class under the new 4-hour format. I like it. I really do. I taught a couple under the 8-hour format where you had to have a minimum of 8 to 10 hours of classroom training. Now it's minimum 4 to 6. And, you know, I like it. I can make the points in 4 hours. The students can pay closer attention when I only have to keep them there for 4 hours before taking them out to shoot. I think that any CHL instructor that is worth their salt, if they can't make the points in 4 hours, then I don't think they're a very good instructor. So I kind of like it. I kind of like it. But Illinois says 16 hours of training. It's 8 hours. Let's see. It says 8 hours of prior training may be credited if it's approved by the Department of State Police. Yeah, right. Like it would be, right? And recognized under the laws of another state or if the applicant is active, retired, or honorably discharged member of the armed forces. Well, that's kind of good. 16 hours of training. Yeah, boy, I tell you what. Now, that's including the live fire component. But come on, folks. We know that the live fire component is, what, 2 hours max? You know, if you have a big class and you got more than one instructor, you can still probably run them through in 2 to 3 hours. So that's a lot of training. It's a lot of training. You know, it's not a Mag 40 course. We're not talking about putting people through a Mag 40 course to get their CHL or concealed carry license. Now, Don, I got to be honest. I haven't gone through the entire law, okay? I'll just be right up front. I probably couldn't read the entire law and be able to stay with it. But I have heard from a lot of folks that it's very restrictive. You know, compared to other states out there, sure, I'm sure the knucklehead politicians in Illinois wanted to make it more restrictive. But here's what I want to say to all my friends in Illinois who listen to this show. It's the first step. Your state has now taken the first step. And as long as those of us in the gun community and those of us who are gun rights activists, as long as we don't step on our you-know-what too much, as long as we don't make a lot of foolish moves, we're going to keep winning this battle. And Illinois might, because they're going to get outnumbered and forced into it, they might ease the restrictions significantly on concealed carry. But Don, I hate to disappoint you. If you want me to analyze the Illinois concealed carry law, it's not really my cup of tea. I do know that it's far more restrictive. It's probably a lot like other states. Like, for example, you know, in other states, it's law enforcement's discretion. Pretty sure that Illinois is shall issue, but I've heard that it's hard to find a gun range to practice in Illinois. And Cook County is like a state within its own state. So, you know, forget about it in Cook County. At least forget about carrying your gun or owning your gun or securing your gun and all that nonsense. But, Don, I would just say I would urge you to look at it as it's a great first step. And that's all I'll say on that. Now, I've got several voicemails about my episode on safety. So here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to take a quick break. After the break, I'm going to let you hear all of the voicemails back to back on the subject of safeties. There's so many of them, this show would get way too long if all I did was talk about these, plus all the rest of them, rest of the voicemails that are yet to come. I've got like 11 or 12 voicemails. Again, far too long for one show. So I'm going to comment about all of these voicemails all at once. You're going to listen to them back to back all at once, and then I'm going to comment on them, and then that'll be the end of this episode. Then I got more voicemails for next week. I don't want to neglect your voicemails because I want you to keep them coming. Here comes a quick break, and then we'll get into all of the comments on my episode on safeties. Well, during the break, there's a few things I want to talk about. Two really important classes coming up that Ben and I are teaching. These are unique. You don't want to miss these if you can help it. Night fighting. We're going to teach our pistol fighting dynamics course, and we're going to teach it at night. Here's the shame of it all when people practice with their concealed carry handgun. Most of the time, they practice during the daylight. And why? Well, because it's hard to find a range that'll let you practice with very little light at all. But you know, a large number of self-defense encounters with a gun happen at night, happen in low light. So here's your chance to do that. We got quite a few people signed up for this class already. And because it's a night fighting course, we're going to have to put some limits on this. So this is pretty much your last chance. If you don't sign up in the next day or so from when this podcast is released, we're pretty much not going to have room for you. So you better hurry up, don't procrastinate, and get over to handgunworld.com and sign up for it. It's $150. It's going to be from 4:30 to 9:30 p.m. 4:30 to 9:30 p.m. Saturday, November 16th at a place to shoot range in San Antonio where Ben and I do a lot of teaching. We're going to spend the first couple hours in daylight, because it'll be light from probably about 4:30 to 6:30 or so. And we're going to practice and get you warmed up, make sure everybody is safe and ready to go and squared away. And then we're going to get into fighting at night. People have been asking me about flashlights. We prefer that you use a handheld flashlight. If you want to bring a weapons-mounted light, that's fine. Bring a weapons-mounted light. Be prepared to work with both, because there might be drills that we're going to ask you to do where you can't use your weapon-mounted light. You can only use your handheld flashlight. So everybody who comes to our night fighting course, bring a handheld flashlight. Bring about 300 rounds of ammo, plenty of magazines, a good holster. Bring some experience drawing from the holster. We really don't want a whole lot of folks. We don't really want anybody who's never drawn from a holster before. Start doing some dry fire practice if you don't have a lot of work drawing from a holster. This is a night fighting class, and we don't want to be dealing with a whole lot of, you know, people who are, you know, trying to figure out, oh, how do I draw this thing safely and make sure I don't put my finger in the trigger. We can't be dealing with that really in this course. Now, there will be drills probably that you won't draw from a holster. You know, we're probably going to be teaching some stuff like moving in a dark room inside of your house. And maybe you're pulling the gun out of the safe and stuff like that. But what I would encourage you to do is get signed up for this class if you want to learn how to fight at night. It's a whole new world. You're going to have a big muzzle blast coming out of the end of your pistol. That's going to change things up quite a bit. And boy, if you think you're a good shooter in the daytime, let's put you out there in the dark and see what you can do. There'll be some ambient light on the range. We do have, you know, we're going to make some different scenarios and things. It's going to be pretty cool. It's going to be an experience that you really can't get in a lot of other places. And speaking of experience you can't get in a lot of other places, on December 7th and 8th, Ben and I are teaching a two-day class, rifle and pistol. The first day is pistol fighting dynamics. The second day is rifle fighting dynamics. And as Ben's talked about, we're going to be teaching some team tactics. So some team tactics, some fighting with your rifle as a team. That's on the second day. Again, if you want to come for just one of the 2 days, you can. You can come for just pistol fighting dynamics or rifle fighting dynamics. You get a discount if you go to both. You can find registration links at handgunworld.com. Speaking of team tactics with a rifle, that's the next video that's going to be posted to the Shooters Club. Ben's working on that right now. He's doing some of the editing. So for all of you who are members of the Shooters Club, that's the next video coming out. There's a lot of good video content and some audio content on the Shooters Club. We've been getting great feedback from it. That's an internet membership site, $75 per year or $8 a month. Go to handgunworld.com, click Shooters Club. By the way, when you check out, there's a web page you have to go to get all your passwords and things like that. For those of you who renew, first of all, thank you for supporting us for this past year. You can renew at the rate of $50. So here's what's cool. $75 one time for a year, and then your renewal rate is only $50 per year. Also, a lot of great manufacturers are giving a lot of discounts. And speaking of discounts, let's take care of some of the people who have chosen to sort of sponsor this show. I want to make mention. First of all, I want to talk about Sturdy Belt. You know, I really like David Scaife's products at sturdybelt.com. I like his belts. I've tested one of his holsters. Pretty good stuff. I'm wearing my Sturdy Belt right now. I say that a lot when I'm doing this podcast because I do this podcast a lot during business hours, and I often wear my Sturdy Belt during business hours. So it's great. If you want a good-looking concealed carry belt that's also a gun belt, go to sturdybelt.com. And he's also giving an extra discount for members of the Shooters Club. Don't forget about American Gun Oil. That's AmericanGunOil.com. Michael's an official sponsor of the show. You can get a discount. There's a special page for Handgun World podcast listeners where you can get a discount if you buy American Gun Oil. So check the show notes. I'll put a link in there. And you can also go to their website, AmericanGunOil.com. Lately, I've been testing out a holster by Polite Society. Polite Society holsters. That's another good company. Check that one out. Polite Society holsters, just Google that. I'll put a link in the show notes. But what I really like about his hybrid holster that I've been testing out, he sent me one, is that he puts a lot of good leather on it, and it's real comfortable. So check out Polite Society Holsters. I'm going to put a link to their Facebook page and good stuff. Don't forget about On Your Six Designs. I think it's some of the best kydex out there. Matter of fact, some of you, when you come to our night fighting class, I'm going to train with one of my On Your Six Design holsters for a little while so you'll get a chance to see it, those of you coming to the class. OnYourSixDesigns.com. Check it out. It's On Your and the number six designs.com. He's also giving a discount, a 10% discount, to Shooters Club members only. And you guys have all been emailed. If you're part of the Shooters Club, you've been emailed coupon codes that you use to get your discounts. So check out these companies. Excellent stuff. And then last but not least, Texas Law Shield. For all of you who listen to this program, go to TexasLawShield.com or USLawShield.com. If you use the coupon code HandgunWorld, you will get 2 months free with a one-year membership. So 14 months for the price of 12 through Texas Law Shield or U.S. Law Shield. That's TexasLawShield.com, USLawShield.com. Get your 2 months free using the Handgun World coupon code. All right? That's it pretty much for the break. Oh, one more thing. Don't forget to make your Amazon purchases on my website. It'll help out my show. It'll help the cause. The holidays are coming. If you're going to shop on Amazon, would you go to handgunworld.com and click my Amazon store? And from my Amazon store, there's a direct link or an icon you can click. If you use my store, I'll get a little fee for referring you into Amazon. It'll help support the show. And you don't even have to spend any extra money. Just do whatever holiday shopping that you're going to do through Amazon, just do it through my link over at handgunworld.com at my Amazon store. All right, that's it for the break. Let's get to the voicemails on safeties.
Hey, Bob, my name is Doug, and I'm calling from Nevada. Actually, I'm calling on your episode on handgun safeties, and I agree with you pretty much. I mean, that's the beauty of us gun guys. We have diverse opinions on everything. I mean, some guys like this, some guys like that. I've got 1911s, and I've got Glocks, and I've owned Makarovs, and I've owned Walthers, and I've handled just about everything. And there are certain things that I do have preferences for. And I see your point of view as far as, not having to think about something at the time you're pulling that gun in a situation that's brought upon you by somebody else trying to harm or kill you. So my wife, she's learned handguns. She's got a concealed weapons permit. She's had several handguns over the span of her shooting, she had some issues with carrying a round chambered, and she had issues with not having a manual safety. And I sat her down and I said, honey, remember when you carried my revolver? I have a little Charter Arms undercover, an old one. She says, yeah. I said, well, you carried around in the chamber with that because all the chambers of the cylinder were full. And the revolver didn't have any manual safeties, but you didn't have any problem at all. There wasn't any psychological hurdle that you had to pass to get past that. And she says, well, yeah, you're right. And she ended up getting a car P380, which she saw your video, which kind of led her to getting it. She really liked your video, and she loves the gun, and she loved the way that the trigger pull. I won't even call it a double action trigger pull. I call it a long single action trigger pull because I don't think the trigger actually does two actions. I think just pulls the striker back and then it lets go. So. But she likes that. It's similar to the revolver in the length of it, and she feels really comfortable with it. She really likes it, and she likes the way it shoots. But as far as the safeties go, the 1911, I'm right with you. I have a really low poundage trigger on there, and it sweeps off really nice, and I've never had any problems with it. Of course, I've never had to fight anybody with it. The Makarov, I'm not a big fan of any of the guns. I love the Makarov, and I love all the guns that I've had. I've loved them for one reason or another, maybe not every reason. But I've come to dislike any slide-mounted safeties or anything that operates from a slide mount instead of a frame mount. I tend to steer away from. But I want to thank you for your show. I think it's fantastic. I listen, I think the podcast is one of the greatest things to happen to the automobile since I've been driving. It's theater of the mind and definitely makes the miles go a lot easier for me, and I thank you for that. I do carry Glock. I carry Glock every day, all the time, and it is comforting. It's one of the few things in this world that I can say I can rely on just about 100%, and that means a lot, especially when it comes to life and death. So, I'm with you. Pull and go without flicking off safety is that works perfectly for me. Thanks, Bob.
Hello, Bob. This is George in Virginia. I'm responding to your show on safeties, the use of safeties or handguns. I actually like them myself, but 2 points I just want to make, and I tell the people who tell me I shouldn't have a safety. One is there are plenty of options either way. So if you like a safety, there's options with them, and if you don't like a safety, there's plenty of guns without a safety. And the other point is that even if a gun has a safety, one doesn't have to use it. So you can just leave it off. All the guns I have with safeties, the safety has to be, actively engaged. It doesn't automatically engage. And if you have a 1911, for example, you don't have to engage the safety. So I think there's plenty of room for both, just like other things in the handgun world. Thank you. Bye.
Hey, Bob. Ryan Clark here. I was calling in regards to your last podcast on safeties. I've been a tactical paramedic since 2002. Just kind of wanted to give my insight on the safeties and the fine motor function that you were referring to as far as being able to activate that safety or not activate that safety in a stressful situation. Let's think about like in the law enforcement scenario, we use sometimes what they call upside down U. That upside down U would be your heart rate arc. So if you were to think at rest, make an arc with your finger. At the peak would be the highest heart rate that you've got during a stressful situation. And then as it keeps going, your optimal performance would be at the top of that arc. And then as your heart rate increases, your performance will decrease also. So, just something to think about that we try to use is what they call IZOF or eyes off. It's an individualized zone of optimal functioning. I know it sounds like a lot of information, but basically just think about these different zones that your body has and optimal functioning of that. So most of the time people are going to fall within that 100 to 115 beats per minute mark, which is going to be actually an enhanced ability to complete a task. Between the 115 and the one up to 145, that's going to be your decrease of your fine motor function. This has been field tested with law enforcement officers, with military, under different situations. Over that 145 peak, then you start to see a decrease in cognitive function, and then you can keeps deteriorating from there all the way up to, you start getting to 200, and that's catastrophic failure, which is typically where, people will get to the point of complete auditory exclusion and complete visual exclusion, which they have no vision or hearing and motor function. So we need to think about, as CCW holders, we need to think about, one, our skill level, our training, and our physical fitness. Physical fitness comes into this huge. So if we're not physically fit, then we're typically going to see a higher arc in that U, and that's going to decrease the amount of motor function that we're going to have to eliminate a task at hand, which means you're going to be less likely able to flip the safety switch. That's considered a fine motor function. So I just wanted to emphasize, like what you bring out all the time, is the importance of training. We're thinking about manual safeties on a firearm for concealed carry, personal protection. Myself, I prefer to carry something that just has a finger safety on it. If you pull the trigger, you don't pull the trigger. However, let's not forget about, the many years that our military and law enforcement have used, sidearms that have had manual safeties and have saved, lives of themselves and others whenever they had to. when they were under duress. Also myself, I come from a tactical paramedic standpoint. You know, we do a lot of very meticulous and tedious things when you're under a lot of duress and pressure. You know, intubating people, surgical cripes, and stuff like that. Things that are very technical that you have to do when you're under duress. So you can create those finite skills, which will almost ingrain them into your subconscious. It becomes a natural process. However, it all leads back to training. So, you know, I think right on, if you want to carry something that has safeties on it, you need to train with it and make it part of your subconscious. And anyways, Bob, have a good day, and keep up the good work.
Hey, Bob, it's Trucker Bob. I just listened to your safeties episode, and I'm in agreement with you. I've had a Glock for 25 years now, since the Gen 1s first came in. Had a couple since then, so, yeah, I love that platform. I've rebuilt a few of them. I think so many times we try to solve software issues with hardware solutions, and it doesn't always work, but yeah, it's definitely a training issue. Those are the Duke Berry 1911s or whatever. I've seen guys run them really fast. I want my defensive gun to be quick, draw, pull the trigger. One thing I did, I learned something here last month. I've rebuilt several of them. I was ROing a competition last month, and guy went to slide lock and popped a new magazine in there, and he jumped his slide stop. And when the slide came forward, the gun went bang. Finger was off the trigger. He was running a Glock. That can't happen. So we pulled the slide off, and his safety was stuck up inside the frame. So, you know, right behind the extractor there, if you push up on your safety, it's on spring tension, and it should be, you know, not flush with your frame. It should be sticking out, and it should move up and down in there. So it was stuck up in there, and as a result, when that slide came forward, just the inertia from the slide, the firing pin bypassed it, the gun went bang. So that could be horrific in your house. Load up your gun, rack it, bang. So, yeah, I don't know if you've ever seen that or not, but I thought I'd pass that on. When you're cleaning your gun, check that part out. It's pretty important. So, yeah, I'm a little more diligent when I'm cleaning now and make sure that part is functioning as it should. Talk to you later. Bye-bye.
Yeah, Bob, this is Mike up in Seattle. And, you know, a lot of good points on your safety show there about all the different kinds of safeties. Well, I'm a 1911 guy. I've carried 1911s for many years without any issues to use them in competition. I do not like manual safeties on my Palmer guns. I wouldn't buy a Glock if it had one, and my M&Ps don't have manual safeties. And I'm not a fan of the magazine disconnect either. I want on a handgun that has one. Actually, one of my first handguns was a Browning High Power. And I'm surprised you didn't touch on the Browning design because of, as far as I know, it's one of the earlier models with the magazine disconnect on it. And the way that worked, it really caused me some problems. And after not very many rounds, only several hundred, I would definitely have issues of the magazine disconnect not engaging and in training wanting to fire the gun by pulling back the trigger and not firing because of the mechanism there and the powder residue, and it just gets dirty. And it was just not a big favorite of mine. In fact, I ended up selling the gun because of that fact alone. So, hey, great podcast. Keep it up. I'm not going to bash you too much if you think it's more of a training issue, but I do see your points on safety. You know, I love my 1911. I love the safeties on them. I'd like to keep them all there. But like I said, the other guns, I think there's no need for a safety on the shield. In fact, I was very disappointed to see it when it didn't come out. regularly. I do not use the safety whatsoever. Okay, Bob, thanks a lot. Good luck to you and your family, and stay safe out there.
Hey, Bob, it's Mike from Jupiter, Florida. Just listened to your show about safeties, and I wanted to make a couple of comments. First off, I completely agree with you with respect to a magazine disconnect safety. I still don't understand why my Ruger has that. However, I think you're confusing training and muscle memory with some kind of natural law. And what I mean about that is your early experience with firearms and most of your experience have been with Glocks with the trigger safety, so you find that very satisfying. Personally, I find it not very satisfying. Every time I holster my Glock, I worry about it because it's so easy for something to get into that trigger guard and fire off around. Also, you know, people drop firearms when they're drawing them, and it's pretty damn dangerous if all you have is a trigger safety when you reach out to try and catch that firearm. It's a grasping impulse. It's quite easy to end up pulling the trigger with potentially devastating consequences. You know, in fact, several trainers all say, if you drop the weapon, let it fall. It won't get broken. Furthermore, you made the distinction that rifles have safeties because they're offensive. Well, that's not really true, Bob. Nobody's really lived until they've been in an ambush with rifles firing at them. If you think your heart rate goes up with a sole attacker or two or three people, imagine having 15 or 20 positions firing at you. And yet, the military, with the exception of some of the special operators, always keep their safeties engaged, particularly when humping through terrain. And, you know, lastly, shotguns. I've done an awful lot of pheasant and grouse hunting. And while they're not attacking me, when a pheasant explodes from underneath your feet, I guarantee you it raises your heart rate and blood pressure. And you know, I always carry my shotguns on safe, and each shotgun that I have has a different safety arrangement. I think it's really a matter of training. With my LC9, I've trained myself when I get my grip on the weapon as it's coming out of the holster. My thumb is already on the safety. As it clears the holster, I disengage, and I'm ready to shoot. And yet I have it on safe up until that point. So I think it's really more, as you say, training, training, training. And there really isn't a single answer to that question. It's whatever works for you best. Personally, I still get a little worried every time I'm holstering a Glock, particularly holstering it in a small of the back or 3.5 to 4 o'clock position. Anyway, another great show.
Hi, Bob. This is Mark from Ohio. I just wanted to chime in on the conversation you had about safeties on personal defense weapons. My wife recently selected an SR-22 from Ruger for her everyday carry weapon. I tried to talk her into the revolver for the same reason you stated, which is basically if she needs to remove it from her holster, the intent is to fire the weapon, and a simple squeeze of the trigger would accomplish that. While I do enjoy the Ruger SR-22, it's fun to shoot, and carries 10 rounds, and it's a good time. It has so many safety mechanisms on it, it's very difficult for myself or my wife to get it to fire the first time. It does have a decocker. It does have the ability to not fire if the magazine is removed from the weapon. And if you have the safety on, let's see, if you push a magazine into the weapon and you have the safety engaged, when you rack a round into the chamber, the hammer is not cocked. You squeeze the trigger, you get nothing. And quite often my wife will turn the safety off, rack the slide again, and eject a perfectly good round out onto the ground. And I really fear that if she ever had to use this weapon for personal defense, that would be the exact same situation she would have trying to defend herself and my family. Keep up the great show. I do agree with you that all these safeties and redundant safeties are a hindrance if the time ever came to use the weapon. I carry a Kar 45 as my personal sidearm every day, and it's really simple to operate. Pull it out, squeeze trigger. There's nicer, more expensive, better shooting, nicer trigger job guns, but mine will shoot if I need it. I'm very confident in that. Thank you, Bob. Have a great day.
Well, lots of opinions, lots of experiences from a lot of people, and a lot of good stuff that was just said there in that string of voicemails. Here's my comments. A lot of you that called in talked about how manipulating safeties is a training issue, and that, you know, I've talked so much about training that I should, you know that it's a training issue. Yeah, for the most part, I agree with that, of course. For the most part, I agree that it's a training issue. You can train yourself to do just about anything. I get that. But what I thought was interesting was, I think it was the last voicemail, I'm having a hard time remembering all of them, but I think it was Mark that said that he felt that safeties, redundant safeties, are a hindrance in bringing your gun into action. They're a hindrance in using your firearm. And that's the whole point that I tried to make back in that episode about safeties. Let's all understand, what is a safety designed to do? A safety has one purpose and one purpose only. That purpose is to prevent the gun from firing. Now, if you're in fear for your life, if you're fighting for your life, why on earth would you want something that would prevent the gun from firing? So many safeties are put in there. Let's see, who was it that said it? That said that it's a software problem being solved with hardware. One of the callers that just called in said that. Right on. Right on. I mean, I think that's very well put. Now, other people have said that. They've said that many times. But with a safety, that's a great point. You know, Doug in Nevada said that, you know, he talked to his wife and he told his wife, hey, you know, remember when you carried my revolver and you carried a round chamber with the revolver? Well, same thing with semi-autos. And speaking of that, by the way, please don't ever carry a gun without a round chambered. A pistol with no round in it is an unloaded pistol. Plain and simple. A rifle without a round chambered is an unloaded rifle. I don't care what the law says. I'm talking about practicality. Anyway, back to what I was saying earlier. These are hardware solutions to software problems. I mean, let's look at some of the safeties. You know, magazine disconnect safeties. That was brought up a couple times in these voicemails, and nobody can figure out why they're on there. I'll tell you why magazine disconnect safeties are on guns. It's a hardware solution to a software problem. You know what the software problem is? The software problem is a knucklehead that forgets to take a round out of the chamber, forgets to properly clear his gun before cleaning it or pressing the trigger or putting it away or whatever. I can think of no other reason why a manufacturer would create a magazine disconnect safety. It's to prevent somebody from doing something stupid. But you can't fix stupid. That's the problem, is you can't fix stupid. No amount of hardware safeties can fix stupid. Now, I want to talk about George in Virginia's voicemail when he mentioned the 1911. And he said, you know, if you have a gun with safeties, you don't have to use them. George, I beg to differ on the 1911. If you have a 1911, you have to use the safeties, especially the thumb safety. Please do not ever carry a 1911 cocked without engaging that thumb safety. If you have a single action trigger, a light single action trigger like a 1911, you have to use that thumb safety. You have to engage that thumb safety when you holster. Meaning you also have to disengage that thumb safety to shoot. Now, the grip safety on a 1911, that's a big argument. I don't understand why it needs to be there. Just like a grip safety on a Springfield XD. In my opinion, doesn't need to be there. Again, why are grip safeties on a gun? Once again, a hardware solution to a software problem. People say, oh, it's safer when I holster my gun. Look, if you keep your finger off the trigger and you look your gun into your holster and don't try to speed reholster and properly clear your cover garment and use the right type of holster, the gun's not going to fire when you holster. Okay? Putting a grip safety on there, if the purpose of a grip safety on a pistol is to help somebody more safely holster their pistol, well, think about that. That means that the person doesn't properly know how to holster their pistol. That's what that means. It means that they don't know how to holster their pistol properly and safely. So what does that mean? They got to rely on the grip safety. No, don't do that. And again, what other reason is there for a grip safety? Think about it. Mike in Seattle say he doesn't like manual safeties on polymer guns, and he's not a big fan of the magazine disconnect. I completely agree. And Mike, you know what? Yes, I forgot about the Browning High Power. I should have mentioned that. One of the very first guns with a grip safety. I don't like the safety on my Smith & Wesson Shield either. The Shield would be an absolutely perfect concealed carry gun. It would be the bomb. It would be the best. The best subcompact concealed carry piece if they'd get rid of that stupid thumb safety. And by the way, if they're going to put a thumb safety on the pistol, they should have made it a lot easier to disengage. It's too thin. It hugs too close to the frame or to the slide. It's too hard to disengage. I'll give them credit on one thing, though, and that is that it's very unlikely for the thumb safety on the Shield to get engaged when you don't want it to. It takes a pretty good degree of force to engage that safety. So that's one thing that I will say that Smith & Wesson Shield did very well. Let's see here. I want to comment a little bit on Mike from Jupiter, Florida. He said something about he might accidentally pull the trigger when grabbing his firearm if he drops it. And then he, near the end of that phrase, said don't grab or something like that. Don't grab the firearm when you drop. Absolutely. Folks, look. Do not, if you drop your pistol when you're training or anytime, if you drop a loaded pistol, do not grab that pistol while it's falling to the ground. It's a natural tendency to want to do that. Don't do that. It's way too easy to accidentally pull the trigger and an accident will happen. Let your gun fall. Your gun is not worth that much. Okay, if it's a $2,500 custom 1911, okay, it might scratch. Yeah, it's going to scratch if you drop it. Well, guess what? You can get that fixed. Is your $2,000 custom made 1911, is it worth trying to save that and accidentally, you know, shooting somebody because you were trying to grab your pistol? So let me talk about that. Please don't ever, ever, ever grab a pistol when you drop it. Raise your hands, let it fall. Mike from Jupiter said that rifles are not always offensive. They're not always offensive weapons, and that I had said that they were. That's true. That's true. I'll correct myself on that. You're right, Mike. Rifles and shotguns are not always offensive. They're often used in defensive. Now, shotguns, you made a comparison, Mike, from Jupiter. You made a comparison on shotguns and bird hunting. First of all, I want to say this. If I'm out pheasant and duck hunting, the pheasants and the ducks are not shooting back at me. So if I have to take an extra half a second to disengage the safety on my shotgun, well, you know, if that extra half a second costs me the opportunity to shoot a duck or the opportunity to shoot a pheasant, well, so be it. They're not shooting back. When a bad guy might potentially be shooting back, or when a bad guy wants to try to slit my throat with a knife, or when he wants to try to hit my kid over the head with a baseball bat, or whatever, half seconds, quarter seconds, split seconds count, and they count big time. My shotgun for defensive purposes, I don't have the safety engaged. Now, that's the one and only weapon where I will not chamber around. Well, why? Because, first of all, I don't carry that shotgun around with me. It's in my home, and I can pump that shotgun. It's one reason why I like pumps. I can pump that shotgun, and I can chamber around really fast. Plus, I kind of like that ker-chunk sound, right? Even though I said don't rely on that, don't think that the bad guy's going to pee his pants and run away like a scared rabbit just because you went ker-chunk and chambered around. But that's the one and only weapon where I won't have a round chambered. Otherwise, everything else, round chambered. These were some really good comments here. I really liked the comment, let's see here. Ryan brought up the fine motor function and the heart rate analysis and things like that. And he says it leads right back to training. That's true. That's true. But he talked a lot. Go back and listen to that again if you have to. Listen to Ryan's voicemail about analyzing the heart rate and what happens when the heart rate gets over 200 and there's auditory exclusion and things like that. And fine motor skills go out the window. Most of the time, disengaging a safety is a fine motor skill. And a lot of you say, well, I can train that. Yeah, you can train that. You can train that on the range. You can train that in a combat class when conditions are right, when nobody's firing back at you. Take your gun with a safety. Take your 1911 with thumb safeties. Take your M&Ps with thumb safeties and go to a force-on-force class. And shoot some airsoft guns with thumb safeties and see how quickly you can bring that gun into action and compare that to a gun without a safety. Get yourself under some pressure. I like what Ryan says. Get your heart rate over 200 and see what happens when you need to disengage a safety and you need to use that fine motor skill when you're freaked out and your heart rate's over 200. Big difference, folks. Something to think about. I like Doug's comment. Doug from Nevada also. I like what he said about a car arms pistol being more or less like a long single action gun. Never thought of it that way. I'm going to borrow that one from you, Doug. I never really thought of it that way because that's true. It's pretty much performing basically one single action. I've called that gun a double action, and, you know, I'm not really sure what it is, whether it's technically double action or single action, but that's kind of a good way to look at it because, yeah, it's long, it's a long trigger pull, but it's pretty much only performing one single action. So, be real careful, folks, about not using safeties on guns. If your gun has a safety and you don't use it, and something happens, an accident happens, and it can be proven you didn't use the safety, that could be used against you, which is why I don't like to carry guns with safeties. I don't mind getting involved in gun games. I don't mind competition with guns with manual safeties. That's fine. Hey, it's only competition. It's at the range. The paper targets are not shooting back. Ducks and pheasant, they don't shoot back. Deer don't shoot back. So have all the safeties you want on those weapons. For me, I'm not going to have a safety that I have to mess around with and try to think about and use my fine motor skills, which I might not have, to disengage that so I can shoot a bad guy to save my life. With all that said, these were very, very good voicemails. I like them. It got me to think about some things. It really got me to think. Most of you know where I stand, and I pretty much thank you guys for sending in these voicemails and calling them in about safeties. What a great subject. And again, when I did that podcast, I knew that it was going to create some definite comments. With all that said, thanks for listening to episode 255 of the Weekly Handgun World podcast. Folks, the reason I carry a gun is because I can't carry a cop. The loudest sound a shooter hears is a bang when he's expecting a click, or a click when he's expecting a bang. And I want to say something about response time. The average response time of 911 is about 23 minutes. The average response time of some of my 9mm ammunition is about 1,300 feet per second. I'll take 1,300 feet per second over 23 minutes anytime. Folks, thanks for listening. Catch you next week. Goodbye.